Now, a few preliminaries on this effort, we'll call it. If you have a Bible, and I think most of you do, this is a Bible class, even though I generally don't use my Bible anymore, but in the back of your Bible, there'll be some pictures or maps, and the one you should have is the one of Judah, Reuben, Moab, and Edom, and Ammon, which was the allotment of the tribes, and primarily looking at the Dead Sea. And I've got one in front of me, and so I'm looking at the Dead Sea, which is north-south oriented. Moab and Edom are down on the right-hand side, and then there's Reuben, and then there's Ammon that pokes across on top of that. And there's a little slice of land on the north of the Dead Sea that takes you over to Jerusalem and down to Bethlehem. And I think that's pretty standard in most maps are laid out. We have three girls that walked from Moab. Two of them made it to Bethlehem. It's 75 or 80 miles. We'll talk about that a little bit more. But we'll look at some important words. I think we need to look at Naomi 25 times. Now, this is the book of Ruth, the Gospel of Ruth, but Naomi's name is there 25 times. And her name means my delight, which is something like I would call my wife for her name. There's another name that she decided to adopt, and that is Mara, bitterness. Now, Ruth, her name is only there 11 times. So her mother-in-law is in there 2.5 times as many times. Her name means friendship. There's Ophrah, and her name means gazelle, and she kind of flew the coop in a way. Elimelech, his name means my God is king, or El, my El is king. Then they had Mahlon and Chilion, who were his sons. Mahlon means sick, and Chilion means pining. So these guys were in trouble before they even left for Moab. Then we have Boaz, who may be the hero of the story, I don't know. And his name means fleetness. And he moved pretty quick when the time came. So that seems appropriate. And then Obed, which was his son, and his name means serving or worship, something like that. Ephrathah, that name comes up. That means a place of fruitfulness. And really another name for the territory of Bethlehem. So if you came from Bethlehem, you came from Ephrathah, and so those names are used almost synonymously. It's like saying, I came from Victoria, but I live in Central Saanich. It's sort of a territory. Bethlehem means the house of bread. And Moab, anybody know what Moab means? We don't generally like Moabites here.
From the Father.
Now, there's a bit of sarcasm in that, isn't it? Because how does that connect up? Well, because Moab and Ammon, who were the sons of Lot, were born by his two incestuous relationship with his two daughters. So when the Israelites thought about Moab, well, yeah. Now, there's one word we won't see here, and that is providence. And we're going to talk about dark providence and light providence. I think sometimes we think it's always just light. And then the word redeemer. Now, we've got two words rendered as redeemer. And one redeemer 7 times and redeem about 7 or 8 times. And it is a primitive root in the Hebrew, and we would probably pronounce it gaol. And that has to do with kinsmen redeemers, which we will, God willing, have a look at next week. Now, more or less, having pulled this subject randomly out of the air, because like, oh, I'm going to do a Bible class, you've got to have a subject, of course, I realized that quite apart from endless classes at Bible schools, conferences, study days, fraternal gatherings, etc., the book of Ruth may well be one of the most well referred to within the long topic lists available. And I'm fully aware of the fact that if you've got a wide margin Bible and you've attended a lot of these events, you've probably got more notes in your margin than I have on 14 pages of notes. More about that later. However, as I began mulling the material over, I realized that I actually knew very little about the subject anyway. And the abiding thoughts and memories were anchored by two comments that stuck with me over the years, and they came from two elder brethren. The first from a brother from Portland, Oregon, who was completely bald, not a hair in his head. And when he introduced himself to me at a study day that I was doing, ironically, on Ruth, he came up to me and he said, well, Brother Schnoblin, my hair is like Ruth and Naomi. And I said, oh, and how does that work? And he said, well, because it knows no parting. I thought that would have got a better response, but anyways. The other lasting note came from a heated discussion with Brother Ivan Thompson. Now, most of you won't know Brother Ivan Thompson, but most discussions were heated. He maintained that Moab was a matriarchal society. And, of course, I questioned him about that, and he wasn't very happy. But his only proof was the comment that they should go home to the house of their mother, which we'll have a look at that God willing in a few moments. He maintained that it was a matriarchal society, the only proof being Naomi's urging to her daughters-in-law to return to the house of their mother. I subsequently have convinced myself, and I'm not that easily convinced on a lot of things, that he was absolutely wrong. And he's not here to defend himself. So what can I possibly say about this amazing book of four short chapters? In the King James translation, there, I think, are 2,574 words. I'm a word counter, so that's important to me. Most of my exhortations are limited to 3,500 words, and I count those out carefully. Now, I had a slow panic the other night when I realized that I had 5,700 words in my notes for the first presentation on Ruth. And I was in a bit of a panic, and I was discussing this with Sean, and I said to him, I have to cut this in half. I need to have only 2,500 words maximum. He says, that's easy. And I said, well, how is that? He said, just read every second word.
It's all true.
It is true, and sometimes you learn stuff from your kids. Not often, but it does happen. I'm going to say this to start with, that the Gospel of Ruth is one of the most endearing, instructive, comprehensive, short love stories ever written. I'll say that again because I know you haven't got it all down. The Gospel of Ruth is one of the most endearing, instructive, comprehensive, short love stories ever written. And I think we can prove that, God willing, in the two nights that we have together on it. I won't start at the beginning. I'll start on a dusty, well-traveled road that leads from the ancient land of Moab, and at the point where it crosses into the territory of ancient Judah. I say well-traveled because there is evidence that from ancient history and archaeology, that people and armies had been moving, especially north and south, through this area for perhaps 1,000 years before our people got there. So artwork that you see, quite often see, of women scrambling barefoot over rocky crags in the wilderness of Judea is probably quite incorrect. This was a well-traveled road. There would have been way stations along the way. Now on this road, we find three women sobbing, crying on one another's shoulders. And a heated emotional debate was taking place. One older woman, a Hebrew, her name is Naomi, and two younger women who were Moabites. Their names were Ruth and Orpah. Finally, one of the younger women, Orpah, turns and walks back down the road to Moab from whence she had come. And as Ruth lingered, Naomi pushes her away, pleading with her to return with her sister-in-law to the land of Moab. But Ruth refuses to return with Orpah. So the remaining two continue north into the Israelite territory of Reuben and then proceed west to cross the Jordan River and arrive at the town of Bethlehem. The trip they had taken from Moab to Bethlehem would have been at least 75 miles, depending on how far deep they were in Moabite territory. 75 miles. They walked, as far as we know, and at probably 5 miles a day, which it's more than I could do, I think, at least 15 to 17 days to get there. And we believe that there, as they say, were way stations along the way. This was a well-traveled road. They weren't just two women walking by themselves with treacherous terrain. Then she arose. We can eavesdrop on this conversation that was taking place in the road that day. And it's a very interesting conversation. Verse 6 of chapter 1. Then she arose with her daughters-in-law to return from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the fields of Moab that the Lord had visited his people and given them food. What do we hear from the fields of Moab? Is it a voice calling us to go home? What is the lure? So verse 7, she set out from the place where she was with her two daughters-in-law, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. But Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, go, return each of you to your mother's house. And again, she maybe have been referring to their unmarried state, perhaps, where they're both now spinsters, widows. In Moab, probably the best place to be for prenuptials, if you needed them, would be back at your mother's house. And she said, please don't go down this road with me. There's no prospects for you on this road. You are Moabites, and where I'm going, people don't like Moabites. So don't come with me. Why don't you just turn around and go back to your mother's house? And she frees them in a way. She just said, you're free from me. You can go. I'll go on my own. And may the Lord show kindness to you. I am not going to be able to show kindness to you anymore. May the Lord show kindness to you, because I can't show you kindness, but the Lord will show you kindness. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. They'd obviously been very fine daughters-in-laws, and had looked after their mother-in-law in her distress, and also her two sons, who clearly had some ailment and died. So to our original point, the mother's house probably had just been a short stay. Hopefully they would find a home in the house of their husbands. Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. And I'd probably say something quite sexist and say, that's what they always do, women, you know. They weep. And God made them that way. And you say, oh, well, you can't say that. But if it was three guys on the road, there'd probably be a couple of fist bumps and a slap on the back, and off they go their own way. But this was a special moment. These were three women there. And they said to her, no, we will return with you to your people. But Naomi said, turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may become your husbands? Turn back. Go your way. For I'm too old to have a husband. And by the way, if I had a husband tonight and I had some children tomorrow, would you wait until they grew up? And of course, they wouldn't. This is just a hint of the ancient custom of widows waiting for the birth of another son to carry on the family name and family tradition. More about that next week, God willing. Would you therefore refrain from marrying and wait all that time? No, my daughters. For it is exceedingly bitter to me for your sakes that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me. It's an interesting comment and point of focus here. Naomi was angry with the Lord. She was angry with the Lord about her current state. She blamed the Lord for the loss of her husband and her two sons. She was bitter, and she showed it. And perhaps a common response when things don't go our way is exactly that. We blame somebody else. I don't know, we blame our brother or some guy down the street, or we blame God. God forbid. When the Lord sends events into our lives to correct us, is that the time to challenge God for treating us with bitterness? Now she has regrets, perhaps, that they decided to move out of Israel into Moab in the first place, or maybe it was herself she was looking at. However, this is what we might call dark providence. We'll try and explain that in a few moments. However, even though the events were clearly part of the will of God, she didn't, of course, have the whole picture. She turned on her God. The love story is full of providence, and what I would refer to as dark providence. There's lots of light providence, as we'll see. Oh, and then in verse 14, they lifted up their voices and they wept again. And Orpah kisses her mother-in-law, but Ruth clings to her. And then perhaps the most memorable part of the text is in verse 15, and she said, see, to Ruth, she says, see, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law. And we'll have to take a few moments to review the gods of Moab. Orpah had definitely decided she was going back to her people and her gods. And so we'll have a look at that in a moment, because there's a comparison that needs to be made when we're talking about the land of Judah and the city of Bethlehem and the land of Moab. Ruth said to her, do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. Verse 16, for where you will go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God will be my God. Where you die, I will die, and there you will be buried. May the Lord do so to me and more also, if anything but death parts me and you. And when Naomi saw that she was determined to go, she said no more to Ruth about it. I had a brief career as a marrying brother, and this particular scripture was often quoted. And I'm pleased to say, as far as I know, it has turned out in a rather positive way. They all don't, of course. During all those moments, and possibly 10 years that Naomi had been together with the girls, what was the main topic of conversation about in Moab? What were they talking about in Moab? That's just a question to leave hanging there for a moment or two. This is really an amazing statement of faith that Ruth makes to her mother-in-law. I've also participated in a number of interviews for baptism. Why don't we call them interviews? I don't seem to see them that way. But this statement of Ruth, fleshed out, would pass the test for a simple response. What is your statement? This is a very strong, positive statement from a lady that knew exactly what she was talking about. Faith comes from hearing, and hearing from the word of God, as we know. Ruth had not seen. She hadn't been to Jerusalem or Bethlehem or Judah. The only knowledge she had, the only source of knowledge she had, came from her mother-in-law, Naomi. And clearly she was impressed, and clearly she had been converted by the words, the endless words and discussions with her mother-in-law. And the question that comes to my mind, because this Gospel of Ruth is full of these questions, and that is, have we captivated our families with the vision of the land of promise? She clearly had captured Ruth's imagination with the vision of the land of promise. Has this developed their faith? Our families, do they want to follow us to the promised land? Well, the sad truth is, again, that some do and some don't. So we'll go back and repeat some of this, back to where it all began. And in verse 1, there's this amazing statement that says, in the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. And we just had a great weekend on the judges. And Judges 21, verse 25 says, in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in their own lives. And Ruth starts out, in the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. I don't think anybody's really positively sure where this Gospel of Ruth fits in, but certainly we have lots of commentary on famines. We'll go to Deuteronomy chapter 11, verse 16. It's one of the ones that pops to my mind. Take care lest your heart be deceived and you turn aside and serve other gods and worship them. Then the anger of the Lord will be kindled against you, and he will shut up the heavens so that there will be no rain, and the land will yield no fruit, and you will perish quickly off the ground, good land that the Lord has given you. And what we're saying is, in other words, that there was no reason at all for a famine in the land of Israel, except Israel's rebellion by worshiping other gods and oppressing their brethren. The sad scenario here, where people in the land of promise, living in Bethlehem, the south of the future Jerusalem, benefiting from the benefits and the mercies of the God of Israel, turn to idols, and it stops raining. And then they wonder why. And I was sitting looking at this a while ago and thinking, this little short love story really reads like a mystery novel, you know, like it was a dark and stormy night. A man from Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the country of Moab. What did he do that for? Oh, he and his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, my God is king, and the name of his wife, Naomi, my delight. And the names of his two sons, sick and pining. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem in Judah. They went to the country of Moab and remained there. I'm not sure that that's cryptic or whether it's prophetical. It was certainly prophetical for the three men. This man of Bethlehem in Judah, what made him decide to pack up his family and go to Moab? I can't read the text without processing that through my mind. Especially because the Jew would have known that the presence of the Lord was related to the land. And then, why leave the house of bread to take your family to Moab, which was a house of death? For reasons that we can briefly explain. Especially a man named after the God of Israel, El is my God. Now, I really can't say I blame the guy, and that is because I've never experienced famine. From the time I was a kid, my mom used to take us up to the corner store, and there was all kinds of food. There was never any shortage of food. There were friendly people up there that wanted to make sure our family was taken care of, and we grew some of our own, but most of it we traded or bought at the local store. However, there's a direct cause and effect in Israel. Turn from your focus on God, the God of Israel, and there will be a shortage of rain. They had all kinds of evidence of that. And that will bring about a famine. Who would have thought? Well, back to Moab. No one in, throughout Deuteronomy chapter 23, verse 2 to 6, no one born of a forbidden union, that's Lot, his family, Moab, may enter the assembly of the Lord even to the 10th generation. None of his descendants may enter the assembly of the Lord. No Ammonite or Moabite may enter the assembly of the Lord even to the 10th generation. None of them may enter the assembly forever. Well, because they came from a forbidden union, and secondly, because they didn't treat Israel properly when they went to move through the land of Moab and they hired a Mesopotamian, it's always hard for me to say that, witch doctor who came to pronounce a curse on them, and the Lord reversed that. Now, the primary god of the Moabites was Chemosh, often described as the abomination of Moab. He was the national deity who the Moabites believed granted them military victories and territorial power. In the Bible, he's closely related and tied to war. And there are a number of historical accounts that refer to this and suggest that worship sometimes included child and human sacrifices in times of severe crisis. Ooh, that would be severe, wouldn't it? But what's even more severe is that in 2 Kings 3, verse 27, King Solomon built a high place for Chemosh in Jerusalem. That can leave you scratching your head. Which was later destroyed by King Josiah. Amen. And then there's Baal Peor, a local Moabite variation of the Canaanite storm and fertility god Baal. The worship of Baal Peor is infamous in the Bible for leading Israelites into sexual immorality and idolatry, and so on, which we read about in Numbers chapter 25. Why would you leave the sanctuary of Israel and of the God of Israel and travel to a country that worshiped a panoply of weird, sick, and strange gods? Why would you do that? Well, evidently a famine. But Moab was a place of dead gods. There's no life in Moab, so again, why do that? And yet, throughout the whole history of Israel, they kept doing it. It's inexplicable. Israel was the land of the living God. But Elimelech, verse 3, the husband of Naomi, died, and she was left with her two sons. These took Moabite wives, and the name of the one was Orpha, the other name was Ruth. They lived about 10 years, and both Mahlon and Chilion died, so that the woman was left without her two sons and without her husband. This was the worst thing that could happen to a woman, losing her husband, first of all, but also losing consecutively her two sons, because that would be how her family would continue, would be either with her husband or with her sons. So here she was. She was bereaved, first of all, by famine in Ephrathah. Second, by the bereavement and the loss of her provider and protector, Elimelech, her husband. Third, with the loss of both of her sons, leaving her with no traditional means of support. No hope for an heir to provide support and nourishment for her in her old age. Both of her sons were childless. She had nothing. Well, except the Moabite daughters-in-law. It was time to finally turn in the only direction that provided any hope. And by the way, the God of Israel and Judah was concerned about the widows and the orphans. I won't give you chapter and verse on that, but you can find that all over the law of Moses. Here, more than that, here was a family, the Elimelech family, that was teetering on the brink of extinction. Father, two sons, gone. Then, when she considers the situation, she decides to go back home. And that's where we found herself on the road that day. Ruth's loyalty to Naomi. Verse 6 again, then she rose with her daughters-in-law to return to the country from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the fields of Moab that the Lord had visited his people and given them food. The great message that they were hearing somehow in Moab while they were working in the fields. She heard it when they were in the fields. So she sets out from the place where she was in Moab with her two daughters-in-law, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. What did we learn? Because these parallels are there for us. Well, I have to say that most of us have been in Moab. The question is, I guess, when did we leave, or have we left? Maybe that we learned, what we have learned in Moab, is that we need to get out. What did they learn that would serve them in good stead in the fields of Bethlehem? At least they probably learned how to work in the fields, maybe gleaning. They didn't have government jobs with pensions and health care. I'm not saying that to try and be cynical, but it's nevertheless a fact of life. But Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go return each of you to your mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you. As you have dealt with the dead and with me, the Lord grant that you may find rest, each of you, in the house of her husband." And she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept again. And they said to her, "No, we will return with you to your people." But Naomi said, "No, no, turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me?" And she had no sons left. She had no future for them in Israel. And by the way, in verse 13, "The Lord has been exceedingly bitter to me for your sake, that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." It's like the Lord had put out a contract on her specifically. We're going to harm Naomi. We're going to teach her a lesson. And she was bitter, as we said. Then they lifted up their voices and wept again, and Orpha kissed her mother-in-law, and Ruth clung to her. And again, going back to this amazing statement of Ruth in verse 15, when she says to Ruth, Naomi says to Ruth, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. We have a bit of a sense of what that meant, the type of people that they were and the type of gods that they had. And so she says, return with your sister-in-law. And Ruth said, do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. From where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. May the Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything but death parts us. So Brother Lynn was right. They knew no parting. And when Naomi saw that she was determined, she said to her, we'll go. She said nothing more about it. And the exhortations, of course, keep popping up from this love story. Orpha went back to the Moabite gods and the gods of her people. Ruth made the right choice and joined her mother-in-law in the land of the God of Israel. This is clearly in the account for our reflection about the choices, about where we're going and where we've been. Her mother-in-law needed support, of course. She could not leave her alone. Ruth couldn't leave her alone and send her back all by herself. And again, the God of Israel cared for widows and orphans. And in this case, it was Ruth that's going to care for her, Naomi. And again, as a clear statement of faith, Ruth's statement was a clear model of confession. And again, as I've already said, have we captured our families with the vision of the land of promise? Has this developed their faith? Do they want to follow us? Well, the sad truth, again, is that some do and some don't. Whatever, however, this is a love story. And that love story asks us, what gods do we love? Which gods do we love? Have we already made that choice as to which direction we should be going, south to the land of Moab or across the River Jordan to the promised land? It seems like a difficult decision to have to make. It shouldn't be. And some of us have probably really not made that decision yet. Still hovering on the road between the two domains, the promised land and the land of certain death. Reminds me of a popular worship song I heard some time ago that goes like this. I have decided to follow Jesus, no turning back, no turning back. Though none go with me, I still will follow, no turning back, no turning back. My cross I'll carry till I see Jesus, no turning back, no turning back. The world behind me, the cross before me, no turning back, no turning back. Of course, Jesus said in Luke chapter 14, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters and gods and all of that, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Whoever does not bear his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. Ruth leaves behind the death spiral of Moab and takes the road to Jesus by participating in the continuance of the kingly line that would bring this disconnected family into the heritage of King David and the Messiah. Ruth leaves behind the death spiral of Moab and takes the road to Jesus by participating in the continuance of the kingly line that would bring this disconnected family into the heritage of King David and the Messiah. When Ruth left Moab, it was clearly for Jesus. When Ruth left Moab, it was clearly for Jesus. And the other question is, do we? Did we? Now, they finally get back. And it's kind of interesting little scene comes about. Verse 19, so the two of them went on until they came to Bethlehem. And when they came to Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. Quite a sensation. The women said, is this Naomi? Is this my delight? Well, they hadn't seen her for probably 10 to 12 years. And, you know, how girls are. Oh, she doesn't look a day older than when she left. And, oh, wow, it's sure, Moab's been sure harsh on her, hasn't it? Oh. And she says, don't call me Naomi, my delight, because I'm not delightful and I have nothing to be delighted about. Don't call me Naomi, call me Mara. Verse 20, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. And I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Well, we'll see about that, girl. Why call me Naomi, my delight, when the Lord has testified against me? The Lord has actually reached out and punished me by taking my husband and my family. The Almighty has brought calamity on me. No, Naomi, the Almighty hasn't brought calamity on you. He's brought salvation. You just don't see it yet. He's brought you back to be at least a surrogate grandmother of the future king of Israel. And not only that, but the Messiah, in the line of the Messiah. But again, on the negative side of things, maybe Naomi was saying to the girls, you don't want to hang out with me, I'm trouble. I'm just bitter, and I'm trouble. Look at what I've got, nothing. But what was it about Naomi that surprised the women of Bethlehem? Was it a happy question? Oh, look, she's back, she's looking great. A question of profound surprise. It had to have been over 10 years since she had been there. So Naomi confesses her sins, her poor choices. However bitter towards her God by the calamity that had befallen her, the book begins with dark providence. And here is an exhortation within this script. How do we respond when the Lord corrects us for the decisions that we have made when things seem to go wrong? It is easy to blame God when things seem to be so bad. Do we? So often we make a public show of it. Poor me. Look at me. God has brought all this calamity upon me. Woe is me. Or are these events meant to shape and reshape our perspective and bring us closer to our God? Get on our knees and talk to God about it. When it is dark providence, we blame others. When it's dark providence, we blame someone else. When it's light providence, on the other hand, we like to take the bow. And that is well documented as we read through the kings of Israel and Judah. It happens over and over again. And again, did you go down to Moab to bring back the great-grandmother of the king that would finally bring peace to the land? Are you listening, Naomi? Because often there's a blessing in disguise. God moves in a mysterious way, his wonders to perform. So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law with her, who returned from the country of Moab, and they came to Bethlehem in the beginning of the barley harvest, which was to be in spring. Important decisions that needed to be raised. Did we return? When did we return? Do we return? What's the best time to return? Well, why did they leave? But some of us are still hanging out in Moab, as I've already said, imagining that there is life there. All the while, there is only death in Moab, and we need to get back to the life and leave the death behind. And so the best time to return to Bethlehem was when there was work. Now, there's a little teaser thrown into the text here, which I find quite amazing. Verse 1 of chapter 2. I think we're in chapter 2 already. We better be. Now, Naomi had a relative of her husband's, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. Oh, Boaz. This is a teaser. We're introduced to someone that has and was not a direct relative, brother, son, or father. But let's ask the question, what would we do on the first morning after a 15, 20-day walk when we woke up in a desolate house and an aging mother-in-law? Sleep in? Maybe. We would have. But not Ruth. No, not Ruth. She had to go to work. She had an aging mother-in-law to support. And so Ruth says to Naomi, and by the way, in verse 2, it's generally, we have the word Ruth, but it's generally Ruth the Moabite, which is kind of a pejorative term, I think it would be. Why would you call her Ruth the Moabite? And it's just like she couldn't forget that. And we'll see it popping up again. She said to Naomi, let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after him in whose sight I shall find favor. Grace, I think, is the word. I will find favor with one of the owners, with one of the property owners, and he will let me, or they will let me glean in the field. And so Leviticus chapter 19 talks about the Mosaic provision for gleaning. And again, the best way to meet would be in the workplace, or at least working. Ruth had experience working in the fields of Moab, it sounds like. Now, gleaning, again, was not a great job. It was basically at the bottom end of the workforce. It would have been somewhat equivalent to going out and picking up discarded cans and bottles. However, Ruth was not going to be sitting around at home. She needed to work. She had an aging mother-in-law that needed to be looked after. So that is the first thing you think about. On the first morning in Bethlehem, get out of bed early. You need to find some work. Now, what time are you going to shut me down?
We still got some time.
10, 15, 20 minutes? So Naomi said to her, "Go, my daughter." So she set out and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened, now the King James Version says, as her hap was, which is one of the reasons why we needed to get a new translation. But she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the clan of Elimelech. Talk about providence. Of all the lessons in Ruth, we can't miss this one. The providence of God. I went to AI, which we do for everything now, and this is what AI said. In a spiritual context, providence refers to the divine continuous care and guidance that the higher power of God exercises over the universe. It stems from the Latin word provido, who would have thought, meaning to see forward or oversight. Rather than leaving the world in a random chance, providence presents the belief that a creator God has all events and natural and natural laws actively sustained and purposely directed toward an ultimate good. From an agnostic AI, I thought that wasn't too bad. Now, there are some simple parts of the love story that make us stop and have a look at ourselves. We need to come to terms with the providence of God and the results of our own free will that make us proud. Good luck. I got lucky with that one. Good call. Luck of the draw. It didn't say that she wandered into this field belonging to Moab. She had some good luck there. She just happened to go in there. No. Well, I had a whole list of verses. The one that came to the top of my mind was, "The lot is cast into the lap," Proverbs 16, verse 33. "The lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord." Yes, amen. "No creature is hidden from his sight, but all are naked and exposed to the eyes of him to whom we must give account." Hebrews 4:13. In other words, we can run, but we can't hide. Or, "Behold, the eye of the Lord is on those who fear him, or on those who hope in his steadfast love, that he may deliver their soul from death and keep them alive in famine." Psalm 33. "The heart of man plans his ways, but the Lord establishes his steps." Proverbs 16 again. "For you formed my inward parts. You knitted me together in my mother's womb." Psalm 139. "I lift up my eyes to the hills. From where does my help come? My help comes from the Lord who made heaven and earth. He will not let your foot be moved. He who keeps you will not slumber." God is providentially in control of our birth, our lot in life, the family into which we are to be born, and the very last day of our life. If you don't believe that, then just take a moment to read Psalm 139. Or as we sung tonight, "When in the slippery paths of youth, with heedless steps I ran, thine arm unseen conveyed me safe and led me up to man." We often need to stop and give our heads a shake, don't we? The normal response to the issue and details of life is that somehow we are in control. That's our natural proclivity. Or at least we continue and conduct our lives as if it was so. The quick, immediate outcome we face is, if we ignore this truth, is in our own natural inclination to believing our own lie. Well, I got lucky on that one. Boy, you see what I did there? I sure made the right decision there. We quickly turn the outcomes on our own selves and ignore the providence of God. We step up and take the bow. The providence of God is at work personally, thoughtfully, individually, directing the free acts of people and devising their way. Oh, we do have a freedom of choice, but it's still God at the bottom of it. And we have to see providence in the dark and the light outcomes in our lives. God sometimes brings dark factors into our lives. We have to live and learn through those times. God is in control, and he knows what is best for us. The whole account of Ruth is a demonstration of the fact that we are not in control. Human thinking and action brought about the tragic events of Naomi's family. However, the providence of a caring God brought them back to a desired end and for fullness and to fullness for Naomi. We must be prepared to say, I don't know, but I do know that God knows, is the simplest way I can think of putting it. In other words, understanding this is my final comment. I want to share with you three words in relation to providence. Three words in relation to providence. The first one is pride. The second one is panic. And the third one is passivity. You see, nobody who understands the providence of God should walk around with a fat head as if they're somehow the author of their own life. Look what I did. Don't let the doctrine of providence let you sit around on your big couch for the rest of your life thinking that God will take care of everything. What was Ruth's response? Was there pride? No. Was there panic at her situation? There well could have been. Strange country, strange land. Waking up in the morning with nothing to do. No pride, no panic. And by the way, no passivity. What did she do? She went to work. And so, let's see how this works out, God willing, next week. And I'm going to leave Jeremy there.